1460 WVOX.
Whitney Media 1460 WVOX presents The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel. Provocative conversation about world issues. Now, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Hello and welcome to our program, The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM. My name is Richard J. Garfunkel. I'm the host of this weekly forum. This program is coming live from New Rochelle, the Queen City, located on the Long Island Sound, and it can be heard live streaming on WVOX.com. One can call into WVOX at 914-636-0110. But as I say each week, please stay germane to our subject. My guest is Andrew Roberts, historian, world-renowned lecturer and commentator and author of the new and exciting history of World War II, The Storm of War. And our subject today is who won and lost World War II and why. Welcome, Dr. Roberts, back to The Advocates, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me, Richard.
You know, Andrew Roberts is the author of the biography of the Earl of Halifax, The Eminent Churchillians, in 1994, a collection of essays about friends and enemies of Churchill, Salisbury, Victorian Titan, the biography of the Victorian Prime Minister, which has won numerous awards for nonfiction, Napoleon and Wellington, an investigation into the relationship between the two great 19th century generals, and a 2003 publication of Hitler and Churchill, Secrets of Leadership, which coincided with his four-part BBC Two history series. He became a fellow of the Royal Society in 2003, and he edited in 2004 what might have been a collection of 12 what-if essays written by distinguished historians. He published in 2005 Waterloo, Napoleon's Last Gamble. He's got a fantastic background in history, and that's one of the prime interests that I have. He last visited The Advocates in September of 2010. We discussed his book, Masters and Commanders, which describes how four titanic figures shaped the grand strategy of the West during the Second World War. It was published in 2008, won the International Churchill Society Book Award. You can still find it, I'm pretty sure, plenty of places. It's a great read. Under his leadership, The Art of War is a two-volume chronological survey of the greatest military commanders in history. The current book and the nexus of what we're talking about, his views on the Second World War, The Storm of War, was published in late 2009 as a bestseller. It reached number two in the London Sunday Times bestseller list. The book was awarded the British Army Military Book of the Year in 2010. He's appeared on U.S. television covering the British royal funerals and weddings. We just saw him on CNN as the commentator on the recent royal wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton. He was born in London, England. He has a degree in history from Cambridge, and where he is an honorary senior scholar and has a doctor of philosophy. In 2011, he was awarded a doctorate by Cambridge University. That's a lot of stuff, Dr. Roberts. I'll call you Andrew. That's a lot of achievements in a short period of time.
Well, it doesn't seem short. I'm 48.
You know, meanwhile, as I say each week, the mission of The Advocates is to bring to the public differing views on current public policy issues. Therefore, public policy is what we as a nation legally and traditionally follow. You know, as curious Americans, my wife and I were up quite early to see the royal wedding of Prince William and Catherine Middleton. We also DVR'd most of the proceedings. And when I saw the royal family at the balustrade of the Buckingham Palace, I was reminded of the VE Day celebration with the then Princess Elizabeth and her parents, the King and Queen, her sister and Prime Minister Winston Churchill. With your historian's eye and perspective, how did the public celebration of this wedding compare with many of the others since VE Day and Elizabeth's marriage in 1947?
That's a very good question. I think it compared very well, in fact. I think the split-second precision of the guards, which is the household division, which is something that we're very proud of in Britain, the way in which our pomp and circumstance can be done so efficiently and faultlessly on occasion, is something that makes people proud to be British. I think that the way in which the Queen's wedding happened in 1947, so soon after the war, during a terrible period of austerity and cutbacks and poverty and the rest, there was what Churchill called a sudden ray of sunlight in an otherwise gloomy time. And I think there's an element of that also with Prince William and Catherine Middleton. We actually are going through quite a tough time in Britain with the recession and the rest. And so that also gave us an opportunity really to have a bit of a party.
And so, and it turned the corner, basically almost closed the book on the tragic circumstances of Princess Diana and her relationship. It almost opened up a new era, even though Prince William will probably wait many, many years to be king.
Well, that's right. I think that chapter is over. One of the great advantages, of course, of having an institution that is hereditary, like the monarchy, is that time passes and the institution rebrands itself every generation.
Mm.
That's very much what happened on the 29th.
Yes, it's a important continuity. You know, returning to the subject of the moment, your work over the past few years has been focusing on both the leadership of the Western Alliance in Europe and the broad scope of World War II with the ebb and flow of this titanic struggle. First of all, in 1939, with a memory still vivid in the minds of most Europeans regarding the carnage of the First World War, was this war still inevitable?
It wasn't inevitable if there was any way of keeping Hitler out of power. But once he came to power in January 1933 as the Chancellor of Germany, then I'm afraid there seems to be no alternative to actually fighting him. War was an absolute prerequisite of the Nazi philosophy. They were always going to try to get living space, Lebensraum, as they called it, in Europe. And as a result, therefore, conflict was inevitable.
Mm. You know, few Americans in this country and probably anywhere else over the age of 40 are not aware or not familiar with the basic history of World War II. Programs like Victory at Sea, The World of War, and many other documentaries have been on television for decades. Numerous films, too many to count, have chronicled every aspect of the war, from the Battle of Britain to the dropping of the A-bombs on Japan. My first question to you is, why did it start in 1939? Was Germany prepared for a world war? And was the timing of the war Hitler's first big mistake?
Germany was prepared in that, in a sense, Hitler had been preparing Germany for this struggle ever since coming to power in 1933. But it was probably not so well prepared vis-a-vis the other powers in 1939 as it had been the previous year in 1938. Hitler felt he had been cheated out of a war over Czechoslovakia in 1938, and indeed it was in the period between the Munich Agreement of October 1938 and the outbreak of war a year later that Britain was able to build the Hurricanes and the Spitfires with which it won the Battle of Britain.
Do you think that in a sense that he, and some historians do believe this, that he should have understood that there could have been a great many powers aligned against him, and that he in retrospect should have waited a year or two more? Or did he assume that this divide and conquer strategy of piece by piece picking off parts of Europe would work?
Yes, he thought it would work, and it had worked up until then, of course. But then in April 1939, the British government laid down a tripwire, really, when it guaranteed Poland. So when, in September 1939, he invaded Poland, war automatically was triggered by him as a result of that guarantee, and it was the right thing for Britain and France to have guaranteed Poland by then, because the alternative would have been for Poland to have been swallowed up, and then obviously Scandinavia, and then he'd have finally attacked France.
Well, it's interesting, too, because as most people who are familiar with the history realize, that the political or diplomatic trigger was this surprising German-Russian peace treaty, you know, as they say, Molotov and Ribbentrop peace treaty that sort of signaled in August that it would war was inevitable. We'll be back to this in a second. We're coming up against a short financial news update. And I want to remind our audiences they're listening to The Advocates on WVOX 1460 AM, live streaming worldwide on WVOX.com. My guest is Andrew Roberts, historian and author of the award-winning book, The Storm of War, A New History of the Second World War. We'll be back in a moment or so.
with business news at 20 minutes past the hour, every hour. Here's the latest update from the Fox Business Network on WVOX Worldwide.
From the Fox Business Network, stocks are edging higher as energy shares rise on a rebound in oil prices. Investors are also awaiting the Federal Reserve's latest assessment of the U.S. economy this afternoon. By checking the Dow Industrials at noon Eastern, they were up roughly 25 points. Shares of Dell are surging today, and that's helping to drive buying in other tech stocks. Investors are reacting to the computer maker's solid earnings after yesterday's closing bell. One analyst called the first quarter profit unexpectedly strong despite concern about a PC maker slowdown and the earthquake in Japan that hurt competitors. And Target says its first quarter net income rose nearly 3%. A strong credit card business offset weak sales. The discounter's profit of 99 cents per share easily beat the street's estimate, but the stock is trading lower after the company suggested on its conference call that analysts' current forecast may be too high. With the Fox Business Report, I'm Adam Shapiro.
Every day, businesses lose critical customer and financial data as a result of cybercrimes, human errors, and natural disasters. Barracuda Networks, the world leader in content security, application delivery, and data protection, with more than 130,000 customers worldwide, can help. Barracuda Backup Service combines local backup and deduplication for rapid restores with data storage in the cloud for fail-safe disaster recovery. Protect your critical data. Visit barracuda.com/backup to try Barracuda Backup Service free for 30 days. That's barracuda.com/backup.
There's always something happening right here on 1460 AM and worldwide at WVOX.com.
Just in touch with what's going on today.
Where many different voices are heard in the land.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates with my guest, historian Andrew Roberts, and we're discussing his new history of the Second World War and specifically how it was won and lost. You know, I have many, many histories of World War II, and I've been reading them since, way back in 1957. All of them before 1970 and the eventual revelation of the ultra secret and the Enigma machine seem quite incomplete, especially when discussing strategy. You devote a great deal of your narrative to not only the technology of war, but to the criticality regarding information. Therefore, Andrew, how critical was breaking of the German and Japanese codes?
Absolutely vital to victory. Most historians, including me, believe that it cut the length of the war by at least a year. In the Pacific War, they were vital for your victory at the Battle of Midway. And in our side of the conflict in the West, we absolutely couldn't have won the Battle of El Alamein without having cracked Enigma. One only has to look at that period when, in January 1942, the Germans added an extra rotor to the Enigma machine, and thereby plunged us into darkness in the Battle of the Atlantic until it was rebroken by the Boffins at Bletchley Park in December 1942, and see the huge increase in the amount of shipping that was sunk in that period to appreciate how important it was to crack those codes.
Now, isn't it true that certainly in the early action in North Africa, Field Marshal Rommel, his reactions to battlefield conditions almost at the head of his troops and his sort of ignoring German high command of OKW remarks confused Enigma. Wasn't there a period of time when people were questioning whether Enigma was correct?
Yes, there was, but fortunately the Germans didn't alter it. They'd invested an awful lot of just sheer sort of belief in the Enigma system, and understandably so, because it was in and of itself an absolutely brilliant machine. It could, in order to send a very short message, there were quite literally billions of different letters that could be used. It was almost uncrackable, and yet the Poles cracked it in 1939 and helped us to complete the job in 1940 and 1941. And so one can understand how the Germans could have assumed that it was uncrackable, and it was a feat of tremendous intellectual ability and power to be able to crack it.
You know, it's sort of an interesting sidelight that Rommel's actions confused the Allies because he was really not listening to commands. But what didn't confuse the Allies were the shipments of oil from Syracuse in Sicily, or Syracuse, which were right on schedule and were absolutely sunk and caused the Africa Corps and the 10th Panzer to run out of oil. To his dying day, Rommel insisted that it was a traitor in the Italian high command that did him in, but it was really a matter of oil and preparation that won the day for Montgomery. You know, it is apparent that, as you mentioned, the Japanese Purple Naval Code was decisive in our victory at Midway, which changed the Pacific War in our favor. In dealing with the German naval codes and the Enigma machines, the Allies had less success early on. With that in mind, how critical was the war in the Atlantic? And of your many what-ifs, if the Germans had started with a much greater submarine force at the beginning of World War II, could the war have ended with a complete strangulation of Britain in 1940?
It so easily could have. When the war started in September 1939, Hitler only had 43 operational U-boats to try to, as you say, strangle Britain. By the end of the war, he had 463, but they were all bottled up in their submarine pens and in the Baltic. Now, if he'd actually started the war with as many submarines as he finished it with, had he put much more effort into the building of submarines the moment he came to power in 1933, he could indeed have strangled Britain. We would have been, because our population couldn't possibly feed itself with the landmass that we have, we would very soon have been starved into a ignoble peace or indeed surrender.
And you know, it's interesting as you describe this fantastic war, this kind of chess game in the Atlantic, dealing eventually with PBY Catalinas, long-range four-engine bombers, blimps, jeep carriers, all sorts of things to mute this incredible threat of the submarines. And I believe close to 1,000 were sunk by the end of the war. And it's interesting that this situation was a critical a problem for the Allies because the German Navy was actually sinking more ships than we could possibly build. And, you know, it's so underthought, that whole issue, the idea of this war in the Atlantic had to be won. You know, before we come to our next break, many modern revisionist historians and armchair generals seem to believe that victory by the Allies was inevitable. Was it our war to lose, or could it have turned out quite differently?
Nothing in history is inevitable. That's the first thing that one learns about history when one starts studying it. Nothing's inevitable, especially not in warfare. No, I think that had the Germans, well, you mentioned earlier about the Battle of El Alamein, had the Germans devoted a fraction of the 3 million men that they unleashed on Russia in June 1941 against North Africa, they could have knocked us out of Egypt very, very easily. We had only a skeleton force in Iraq and Iran, and they would then have been able to have taken 80% of British oil production. The alternative of bringing oil across the Atlantic was incredibly expensive in terms of blood and treasure, and that too might have knocked us out. Had he then been able to have attacked the Caucasus from the south, he would have been able to have taken 80% of Russian oil production as well. So it's very easy, and there's obviously nothing inevitable about his declaration of war against the United States, an uninvadable country. So it seems to me very clear yet that, yes, the Second World War could have gone the other way.
Yeah, and it's very interesting from a perspective of how, as you describe, and you know, so intellectually and intelligently in your books on the great commanders of history, the great captains of history, that these two seemingly strategic mistakes, focusing on Leningrad, focusing on Moscow, not focusing on the Caucasus or the Middle East, where the bottom line is that oil drives an army. We have to go to a break for a commercial. I want to remind our audience they're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX with my guest, historian Andrew Roberts. We've been discussing World War II. his new history and how the war was won and how the Axis lost it. When we come back from a break, we're going to discuss some of the critical turning points of the Second World War. We'll be back in a few minutes. Thanks.
National news 3 times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio. I'm Ron Flatter. It was strongly hinted yesterday by the White House. Now the Obama administration may have followed through. Various reports saying the U.S. has imposed its first ever sanctions on Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad for human rights abuses. Spokesman Jay Carney yesterday saying the White House was disturbed by the deadly confrontations between anti-government protesters and Assad's forces.
Flipping deadly weapons into our ports. Indeed, every American can be proud of our brave military and intelligence personnel who made sure that the terrorist leader who attacked us on 9/11 will never threaten America again.
That's President Obama speaking right now at the graduation ceremony of the U.S. Coast Guard Academy in Connecticut. On his way there, the president was briefly interrupted by bad weather. Air Force One needed to circle once before landing at an airport in Connecticut, but the FAA says the president was never in any danger. Fox News, we report, you decide.
A lot of people sell office equipment, copy and fax machines. Some of the technology they're peddling is superb, and some of it is not so stellar, I'm afraid. Thus, the dealer you buy from is just as important, you know, as the brand you select. Since 1972, the most respected, reliable dealer has been Vista Business Products. George and Bob Forstbauer's Vista, number one authorized Canon dealer in the tri-state area. They're the oldest and most established. So for the very best up-to-the-minute technology in copying, document management, rely on Vista, the newest technology from the oldest dealer. Westchester headquarters in Elmsford off 287 and 119. Call George or Bob Forstbauer, their sons George Jr., Bob Jr. There's even a daughter, Christine, in the family business. Vista Business Products and Canon.
Call 914-347-7888 or visit us on the web at www.vistacanon.com.
Today's public affairs and issue-oriented community programs are brought to you by the Westchester Law Firm of Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss. This highly regarded regional firm handles matrimonial law and difficult family issues like separation, divorce, alimony, custody, and reconciliation, and is widely known for the caring personal interest and compassion its highly skilled attorneys bring to this most sensitive area of the law. Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, located in the heart of downtown White Plains in the Clarence Rapelier Building at 123 Main Street. The firm is led to this day by managing partner Henry Berman, a former chairman of the family law section of the prestigious New York State Bar Association. For a confidential consultation about matrimonial matters and family law issues, you're invited to call Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, a professional corporation of highly qualified lawyers handling matrimonial law in White Plains at 123 Main Street, 914-997-7100. The Westchester Law Firm with the statewide reputation, Berman, Bavero, Fruco, and Gauss, 914-997-7100.
I'm not comfortable with this. I think Jason should go to college now. I don't want him putting this off. He's already talked to a recruiter. Could you just talk some sense into
him? I understand, but I think if you just listen to him, you'll see. His decision makes a whole lot of sense. He wants to go to college right now, but he also wants to serve. That's why he's been talking to a National Guard recruiter.
The National Guard gives young men and women the unique opportunity to serve their country and communities part-time while they attend college.
You know, we've also got to figure out how we're going to pay for all this. The way things are these days, tuition, room and board, they're through the roof. And with our finances...
No, honey, don't worry. He's worked that out with the Guard recruiter, too.
Plus, with the National Guard scholarship and other financial benefits, college students can graduate debt-free. Get to know what serving in the National Guard can do for your son or daughter. Visit NationalGuard.com.
sponsored by the New York National Guard, aired by the New York State Broadcasters Association and this station.
There's the updated weather forecast for Westchester County and vicinity. We have periods of rain and isolated thunderstorms for today and tonight. Some of the rain could be heavy at times. Because of all the rain of late, we have a flood watch. It's continuing to stay in effect through late tonight. Highs today, mid-60s. Lows tonight, mid-50s. So a narrow range in temperatures within 10 degrees. It'll be mostly cloudy on Thursday. The possibility of some drizzle and fog in the morning. Showers and some scattered thunderstorms afternoon and evening. Highs tomorrow, upper 60s. Lows at night, mid-50s with a chance of showers. Friday, about the same, mostly cloudy. And still that possibility of some rain and drizzle, too. There's that chance of an afternoon thunderstorm with her highs in the lower 70s. By Saturday, however, partly sunny, highs mid-70s. And Sunday, looking partly sunny, middle 70s as well. I'm meteorologist Steve Pelletieri for WVOX Worldwide, WVIP HD.
This is America's great community radio station.
Really seems to be in touch with the heartbeat of the city.
AM 1460 WVOX.
The voice of Westchester, 1460 WVOX.
Now, back to The Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to The Advocates and my guest, Andrew Roberts, historian, lecturer, political and social commentator, and recently back from the royal wedding as CNN's man in London, commenting on the royal family, its impact, and the pageantry they are so skilled at performing. Your book on World War II, The Storm of War, dealt with each theater of the war chapter by chapter. You draw many conclusions about the grand strategy, tactical successes and failures. Since we have a limited amount of time, Andrew, tell us first about Hitler's failure at Dunkirk, and then with the ensuing air war against Britain, and why it failed.
Well, the problem at Dunkirk was that Hitler, on the 24th of May 1940, gave a halt order to his panzers above the town of Dunkirk, which wasn't countermanded until the 28th, 4 days later, by which time the British Expeditionary Force was able to get itself and some French divisions back over the Channel and back to freedom. The way in which there are a number of reasons that he gives. Have been given by historians for this disastrous error. One of them is that it was an attempt to make peace with Britain, and he didn't really want to capture the British Expeditionary Force. Now, in my book, The Storm of War, I have discovered a document which completely explodes this myth. It's a letter from Major General Alfred Yerdal of the planning staff of OKW, and it says that the Führer was that day looking forward to scooping up the French and British armies. And so that completely explodes this idea that he wasn't trying to capture them. As far as the Battle of Britain is concerned and the air war, Hitler again made a disastrous error on the 7th of September 1940 to stop bombing the British aerodromes, the RAF aerodromes in the south, places like Manston and Port Lim and Biggin Hill, and instead concentrate on bombing the Docklands and the East End of London. And that gave the RAF a crucial moment in time to repair their command and control systems and to refill the bombing craters in the runways.
Mm. We have a caller. Please go ahead, caller. Give us your name and state your name to our subject, please.
Yes, it's Mr. Camp from New Rochelle. Good afternoon. I would like to get to something that I've heard here to kind of be a little critical of some of the allies instead of old Adolf, who obviously made plenty of mistakes. We got caught flat-footed at the Bulge, and there's been no good reason that I've heard of why that happened. Secondly, we invaded Normandy, the U.S. did, and attacked cliffs, whereas the British, I understand, I think it was Omaha Beach, which was flat, and they suffered very few casualties. We suffered enormous casualties. So this kind of implies that Eisenhower made a mistake here as well, or that there were some Allied follow-ups there. Can you comment on these two? And I've heard that people were criticizing Eisenhower one way or another, either the British or other Allies were.
Thank you for the call. Let him answer. Thank you.
Yes, that's a very both of those are very good points. I certainly don't in any way in my book attempt to whitewash the Allies. Many mistakes were made. One could also add, of course, the Dieppe raid and the Operation Market Garden, the bridge too far at Arnhem. You know, there were significant defeats, and especially earlier on in the war.
Kasserine Pass. Kasserine Pass, too.
Yeah, to Kasserine Pass, absolutely. The and I go into each of these in the course of the narrative of my book. But to answer your question, your specific questions, with regard to the Battle of the Bulge, it was an absolutely astonishing attack that was unleashed in the Ardennes in the December of 1944, a 39 divisional surprise attack, which could only have happened if there were no radio communications whatsoever between the German generals. Every which could be picked up, and of course, as we mentioned earlier about Enigma, the codes could have been broken, and we would have found out that this was about to happen. As it was, however, the Germans passed every single message to corps commanders from by motorbike rather than by radio. And then they attacked in the middle of the night, bouncing the searchlights off the clouds and going through 3, 4, 5 feet of snow in some cases. It was an incredible assault, and one that Eisenhower really is not guilty for not having been able to have foreseen. When one thinks that 540,000 Germans were being scooped up and captured or killed in the Bagration offensive on the Eastern Front, and then at exactly the same time they're able to unleash this amazing assault to the Channel, it's a tribute to the resilience of the Wehrmacht, effectively. Your other message about the question about the beaches. Yes, it's true that Utah and Omaha, the two beaches that the Americans were assigned to capture, were, and in particular Omaha, were very, very difficult and very well defended. But it's not true to say that the Canadians who landed at Juneau or the Britons who landed at Sword had an easy time of it either. There was they also took some pretty serious casualties, and they didn't get as far. They didn't capture Caen, for example, which was supposed to have been captured on D+4 for many weeks, so several weeks at least. So it's a and then once they did get there, they were holed up there really from the counterattacks that the German panzers unleashed from the south. So you know, then the next battle, the Battle of the Falaise Gap, was an actually brilliantly well planned and fought campaign by the Allies. So you know, yes, of course there were lots of teething troubles. Yes, of course there were lots of defeats, especially in the Far East at the beginning, but the point is that the British and the Americans learnt their lessons as the war went on in a way that Adolf Hitler simply didn't.
And you know, it's so true. Just a quick answer is one of the reasons why they climbed the cliffs there was there was big guns on top that they thought and understood that would threaten the fleet. So
that's
that
right, yes,
there's no question about that. Yeah. And, you know, I think the as we're moving to our next break, I think two critical points I'd like you to dwell on are the twin declarations of war. The declaration of war in the United States, was it necessary? Was this a terrible mistake by Hitler? And the delayed invasion of the Soviet Union, or even the invasion of the Soviet Union. Were these two twin acts, did this seal his fate?
They did indeed, yes, and to think that they came within 6 months of one another is very interesting and apposite. The declaration of war against an uninvadable country like America, for the most ridiculous of ideological reasons, the fact was that yes, there were some problems in the Atlantic with the Americans, but you shouldn't go to war against what was going to be the arsenal of democracy unless you'd worked out some plan to maybe shell Manhattan or in some way cripple America. And there was absolutely no plan to do this. And so as a result, just simply because he believed that America wouldn't be able to, he actually said he didn't believe that they would be able to land troops in Western Europe until the year 1970, because he believed that America was ruled by blacks and Jews. He obviously hadn't looked very carefully at the makeup of the Roosevelt administration, but it was just Nazi racism and fascism that led him to this appalling blunder.
Andrew, we'll get back to the Soviet Union in a minute. We have to go to a break for a commercial. I want to remind audience you're listening to WVOX 1460 AM. We're live streaming on WVOX.com. My guest, historian and author Andrew Roberts, we're discussing World War II, his thoughts and conclusions. We'll be back in a moment.
World and national news three times an hour. Here's the latest update from Fox News Radio on WVOX Worldwide.
Fox News Radio, I'm Lillian Wu. Reports say for the first time, the U.S. will impose sanctions on Syria's president for human rights abuses. This in escalation of Washington's pressure on Damascus to ease its crackdown on protesters.
The Assad regime is trying to control the airwaves, cell phones, and internet, but eyewitnesses have been able to post YouTube videos and eyewitness accounts using social media like this protest.
Fox Radio's Courtney Keeley in Connecticut. The commander-in-chief gets a rousing welcome at the Coast Guard Academy in New London, President Obama delivering the commencement address. And as her husband, Mark Kelly, commands Shuttle Endeavour's mission at the International Space Station, wounded Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords undergoing surgery to replace a portion of her skull today. This is the shuttle's final time at the space station as NASA winds down its program. Fox News, we report, you decide.
It's time to do it myself. Well, I know a place where the answer's right on the shelf. They got the solution to help me get it done. A local institution. They make hardware fun.
When we need to record a song, we go to the Loft Recording Studios. But when we need some hardware, we go to Cornell's. 310 White Plains Road, Route 22, Eastchester, New York. Cornell's!
Most people resist change and try to hold on to the past. But change is inevitable and the future is upon us. In fact, at no other time in our history has a society been subject to such an accelerated degree of transformation. From technology to communications, to global markets and commerce, we've seen dramatic shifts that have corresponding and drastic adjustments to the landscapes of business, politics, and our everyday lives. This is Andy Spano. Monday at 10, we'll talk about these topics and more. The show is called Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow. Each week on WVOX, we'll talk about how we got here, where we are, and where we are going. Join me Monday morning at 10 on 1460 WVOX and worldwide at WVOX.com.
From the historic city of New Rochelle, home of Ursuline Academy, Irma Valencia, NFL star running back Ray Rice, and the Sound Shore Medical Center of Westchester, the great and growing hospital for you and yours.
About you get on the radio
and you broadcast from room to room and even house to house.
Call David O'Shaughnessy 914-636-1460.
1460 WVOX.
Now back to the Advocates with Richard Garfunkel on 1460 WVOX and WVOX.com. Join in the conversation at 914-636-0110. Once again, here's Richard Garfunkel.
Welcome back to the Advocates. My guest, historian and author Andrew Roberts. Before our last break, we were talking about strategic eras. Most historians cite America's massive production, or as FDR called America, the arsenal of democracy, as the reason the Allies won the war. Is this too simple, or should we give much more credit to Russia and the two-front war Nazi Germany had to fight and the inherent lack of coordination with the Japanese?
Well, I think certainly the fact, the straightforward statistic, that for every five Germans killed on the battlefield, by which I don't mean bombed from the air, I mean actually fighting on the battlefield, four of them died on the Eastern Front. So, of course, while America was the arsenal of democracy and produced the most fabulous array of tanks and planes and warships, you nonetheless needed to have the Soviet Union fighting the Germans on that vast 3,000-mile front for 4 years and losing, in the Soviet terms, no fewer than 27 million people in order to sort of weaken the Wehrmacht to the extent that we were then able to attack in the West.
You know, and it's also interesting, that is a two-part sort of question to the Eastern Front. A, the decision to invade Soviet Union, and B, the delaying of the decision by his adventure in the Balkans. Which was worse?
Well, they were interconnected, really. They were pretty much the same thing. Once he had made up his mind to attack in 1941, he shouldn't have gone into the Balkan adventure. However, and once he did, that did slough off some of his forces. It didn't significantly change the actual date of attack, which was far too late in the year anyway. They needed to have an extra 2 months or so before the first the rains in October and then the snows in November started enveloping the German army.
And he didn't learn from Napoleon's conflict with General Snow, you know?
Absolutely astonishing. I mean, not least because the German infantryman wasn't given thick enough winter overcoats. And, you know, part of the reason, and I argue this in my book, The Storm of War, there's a passage about Hitler's absurd belief that the German master race didn't need to wrap up as warm as Slavic Untermenschen, or subhumans, as he
right.
called them.
That's cold.
That they were actually much tougher than the Slavs, and therefore wouldn't need the winter overcoats. It's yet another example of him putting his fascist ideology before the best interest of the Wehrmacht.
Right. You know, you devoted a great deal of your work comparing the great military commanders of the last 200 years in the Art of War series, along with books on Wellington and Napoleon, Alan Brooke and George Marshall, and Churchill and Hitler. Who gets your highest marks for military and political leadership during World War II?
Well, I think in military leadership, some of the Russian generals, Rokossovsky, Konev, and Zhukov, obviously tremendously important. Some of the German generals, Manstein, Rommel, Guderian, you know, these people were very fine military commanders. When it came to and America, clearly, I'm a strong advocate for Eisenhower and obviously Patton, to a lesser extent Bradley, and to a much lesser extent Clark. And in Britain, we had Monty, and I'm afraid not an awful lot more.
And of course, you have MacArthur in the Pacific.
And you have MacArthur in the Pacific. I'm sorry, yes, I should definitely have mentioned him. And we can argue, you know, for ages about various individual people, but when it comes to the great military, great political leaders, and also, sorry, to the general staff, I mean, George Marshall and Alan Brooke were really, really superb strategic brains, and we were very fortunate to have them too. At the political level, well, FDR really did. He was the man who, at the Washington Conference in June 1943, insisted on the date for D-Day. And he, by that stage, in the calendar year 1944, America was producing as many warplanes as the rest of the world put together. So he had the clout to do that. And, of course, you can never detract from Winston Churchill's vital, central role in 1940 and 1941 in keeping Britain in the war for that vital year between the disaster of Dunkirk and Hitler's invasion of Russia.
And great inspirational leadership. You know, one of your conclusions was that the lack of real cooperation between the Axis powers hurt their war aims. Isn't World War II a number of separate and distinct wars with diverse theaters engaging different powers for different reasons?
It very much is, yes, absolutely. Now, I think that's a very perceptive point and something that I do try and bring out in The Storm of War. The fact is that the Japanese and the Germans fought pretty much two separate wars. They didn't even cooperate and give information with regard to anti-tank weaponry, let alone actually telling each other what was going on. I mean, it came as a complete shock to Hitler, the news of Pearl Harbor. He wasn't informed beforehand. Neither side tried to coordinate their efforts against the Allies at all, and we're very fortunate that they didn't.
Right. You know, your book goes into a great deal of detail about strategic mistakes Hitler made. But one thing you mentioned, too, was very interesting, Hitler's aversion to airborne assaults after the invasion of Crete, which could have been very decisive in terms of the Suez Canal and other areas. Were there other decisions like the delay in the development of the jet fighter, the lack of long-range four-engine bombers, or the production of too few, let's say, less expensive tanks, more mobile tanks? Didn't this doom the Third Reich?
It did. For a man who's supposed to have an iron will, Adolf Hitler constantly changed his mind, especially about his generals. On the Eastern Front, he sacked Gerd von Rundstedt no fewer than four times. He moved Merdel three times to different fronts in the course of the year 1944. He was constantly sacking and then reappointing generals. And as you say, with the ME-262 fighter, turning it into a bomber, then turning it back into a fighter, then back into a bomber. You know, these created appalling bottlenecks, production bottlenecks, which worked to the detriment of the Germans.
You know, the war in the Pacific was fought by less than 15 American marine and infantry decisions. It was mostly a naval war fought by hundreds of ships, thousands of planes, and millions of men, along with the less glamorous China, Burma, India theater, which featured interesting and eclectic leaders like Bill Slim, Ord Wingate, Vinegar Joe Stilwell, and Claire Chennault. Could one conclude that the victory in the Pacific, especially after Midway, was preordained and inevitable, though bloody?
Just to go back to my earlier remark, nothing in history is inevitable. What if you'd had those four aircraft carriers that were on patrol at Pearl Harbor actually in harbor, and had all of them been put out of action? Yes, America was to produce another 15 aircraft carriers in the course of the war, but the fact is that that war, which, thank God, was ended by the atomic bomb, had it not been ended like that, could have gone on to kill... Well, an invasion of the Japanese mainland would have cost, and pretty much every other sensible historian puts it as high as another 250,000 casualties, American casualties. You know, these things, there was a fanaticism to the Japanese defense. You see it on Okinawa, you see it on Iwo Jima, that if it had also been taking place on the mainland, and there's no reason to suppose that it wouldn't, would have created very many more widows and orphans in America.
You know, we're coming to the end, unfortunately, this hour, in the concluding moments. You mentioned a reason at the very end of your book. What was the one factor that doomed Hitler from the start, you believe?
It was that he was a fanatical, unregenerate Nazi who constantly put his ideology before the best interests of the Reich.
When, Andrew, will this book be available in America?
Today is the day of publication.
Excellent.
Yes, you're the first person to interview me on radio after this, and there are many, many more, but it's very, very exciting to have today being the big day for me.
Well, I thank you. You know, it's interesting, and I mentioned to this off the air to you know, I have hundreds and hundreds of books on World War II, and I read most of them in our local library, which is a very large library in Mount Vernon, back in the late 1950s, and I really have—I must say this with an unsolicited purpose—that this is one of the great books. That this is very interesting. Your style of compartmentalizing each area was great. It was fantastic. I recommend The Storm of War to everybody. In the last 10 seconds, is a new project on the way? You can give us a sneak preview, or is it too early?
Yes. No. I'm writing a biography of Napoleon, and there are plenty of books on that as well, as you can imagine.
No question. Napoleon, maybe you'll write as Napoleon as the liberal. You know, many people thought of him as a, I know you don't go from that proclivity, but is it possible that Napoleon was a liberalizing factor in
Europe?
He was
certainly a liberal at the end of his career. He abolished slavery, and he abolished press constraints. Certainly in the last sort of year in power, he followed a liberal empire. Yes, no, you're right.
Thank you very much. I hope to have you back on when this is ready. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you.
Next week, I'll be discussing crime and fiction with former New York City prosecutor and award-winning mystery writer Linda Fairstein. If you want to hear this broadcast or any of the other archived Advocates broadcasts, you can access them on my website, advocates-wvox.com, with the information my guests will be posted. Thank you again to Andrew Roberts, historian, author, lecturer, commentator on his great book, The Storm of War. Please pick it up today. It's available. Thank you. Bye-bye.